That's the big social event of the year. Make sure you're there. We open your Bibles to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Now, last week, we dealt with the sort of the first three verses of this book to form a background for the book. The introduction actually runs all the way to verse 11. And in verses 4 to 11 of chapter 1, the author is going to deal with how transitory and cyclical aspects of life under the sun are. If you were not here last week, we discussed the fact that Solomon was the author of this book and that he probably wrote it very, very late in his life, probably shortly before his death. And at that time, Solomon, as far as interpreting divine viewpoint was concerned, he was worthless. His frame of reference had degenerated, had retrogressed so vastly and so badly that his advice is at best shaky. So that what you read in Ecclesiastes you should compare with other scripture. Okay? So let's note just the first three verses. The words of the preacher, the word for preacher is koheleth, which means a gather, one who unites an assembly. The son of David, he claims to be an offspring of David. King in Jerusalem, he claims to be king. Now, when we're going to see, and as we work through chapter 1, that the person that had the experience to write this book, with the identity that's given, it could probably be no other than Solomon. Immediately in verse 2, he talks about the vanity of life. He says, vanity of vanities, and the word is hebel, which means emptiness, fruitlessness, vacuum-type situation, meaninglessness. Saith the Koheleth, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit has a man of all the labor that he taketh under the sun? Now that third verse is a sort of a lead question for the book. He is saying, what benefit has a man for all the struggles that he has under the sun? And the word for labor there can mean actually his physical labor, or it can mean his struggle to interpret the meaning of life. What good is it? What does he have in all of this struggle that's of benefit? And you're going to find that statement repeated throughout the book. Okay? Now he continues in this sort of a morbid frame of mind through practically the whole first four chapters, and particularly in the theme. So I want us to note verses 4 through 9, which form a sort of an example of repetitious activity that this person who has written this book has observed relative to life under the sun, relative to man with the light of the sun as his best light. In other words, this book is disregarding extra revelatory concepts of God or special revelation from God. It is dealing with man under the sun and his struggles in there. Now in verses... I forgot my pencils. Would somebody be kind... okay. Would you get... I think they're on my desk, Doug. In verses 4 through 9, he has four examples of repetitious activity that practically anyone that thinks about life observes. Verse 4, life is cyclical. One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abides forever. In other words, the earth remains firm. There isn't much change in terms of earth processes, but there is a transitoriousness of the generation of human beings. One generation pass away, but another generation comes. And then that one's going to die. And then there's another one going to take over, and so on. Now, the author of Ecclesiastes is not considering here the fact that the earth itself has been changed by cataclysmic judgment of God. Nor has he considering that there's going to be a future change in the earth. All he is doing
is observing uniformitarian processes in this particular section. Thanks, Doug. Okay? Now, this is going to depress him somewhat. See, it's going to add to the depressive tone of the book. So what we have in verses 4 through, well, it's actually through, that's through 9 is okay. Or at least four examples of repetitious activity. Repetitious activity under the sun. Okay, now under the sun, we say, is this concept in Ecclesiastes, another phrase that's repeated throughout the book, that deals with man, thinking man, without special revelation. Okay, the first one is the example of the life cycle. Life is cyclical. Okay, the second example was going to be the sun. Like generations that come and go, so is the sun, verse 5. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and in hasteth to his place where he arose. And the concept there is that the sun is incessantly active. There always seems to be some type of movement. And he is speaking, of course, from an anthropocentric or an earthocentric viewpoint of the cosmos here. So he speaks like the morning paper does, about the sun going down and the sun coming up, right? So here, like the generations, there is a ceaseless, a restless motion of the sun that is in view. And this is a fixed thing. You can observe this every day. Any generation can observe this. Any individual can see this. This restless motion of the sun repeats itself. And it doesn't seem to have any vital meaning to the author of the book. Okay? He moves from the sun to the wind, to the, what would we call that? Numismatics? A numismatist is a stamp collector. Why is a stamp collector called a numismatist? Oh, it's, how's it spelled? Does anybody know? N-U? N-U, okay. I thought it was spelled P-N-E-U. Okay, this is numismatics, P-N-E-U. Numa, the wind. And there is a ceaseless activity there. Verse 6, the wind goeth toward the south, and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth, and the word for whirleth there means circles. It doesn't always circle from the north to the south, but it circles about continually. It's always moving around in circles. Okay? One day it's coming out of the east and blowing toward the west. One day it's coming out of the west and blowing toward the east. It seems to be always whirling around. And you have again this concept of ceaseless cyclical action of the wind. Okay? So he's saying in the third illustration, there is there are prevailing circuitous wind patterns. And you get the idea here, see, of activity, but it is not too meaningful in its sense. And here the wind has ceaseless movement in all directions of the compass, ever repeating itself, nothing permanent except the permanency of fluctuation. Nothing new except that the old repeats itself is the idea. In verse 7, he switches to hydrological processes as an illustration. The water processes or the hydrology of the earth. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place whence the rivers came, thither they return again. Why doesn't the sea fill up? You know, if you go over and you look at the You look at the Blue River, okay? Let's trace the Blue River. Blue River flows down through the Breckenridge Valley and down into, what's the lake? Dillon Dam. Flows out of Dillon Dam, flows down to Kremling. West of Kremling, it joins the Colorado River. Colorado River winds down, way down, all the way through Arizona, where they make money off of our water while we pay exorbitant rates on the eastern slope. And it goes, where does it end up? Pardon? Gulf of California? Down in the Pacific somewhere. Okay? Where? No. It has to be the West Coast because it's a West Slope River. Gulf of California. Yeah, down the Baja River. Baja, or whatever it is. Baja. All right. All right, I'll trace one you don't. Where does look at the Yaquegani River. There you are. Now, I throw you in a tailspin. Yaquegani River flows north into the what? Monongahela River. Monongahela River flows west into the Ohio. It hits the Allegheny, and they form the Ohio at that famous place, Pittsburgh. And it flows... west, southwest, into the Mississippi. The Mississippi flows down into the Gulf. Why doesn't the Atlantic Ocean and Pacific Ocean fill up? Well, there's another hydrological process going on, isn't there? The winds are blowing over the Pacific Ocean and gathering up moisture out of the Pacific Ocean into the clouds. The clouds are... The general airstream pattern of the jet stream is west to east, and it's pulling those clouds over the mountains, and they get over certain mountains in California and drop a little bit of moisture, and if they can get a little farther west or east, they drop some moisture on the Rockies, and the circuitous pattern, the cyclical pattern of hydrological processes, you see, repeats itself. Moreover, God has fixed, we're told after the Noahic catastrophe, He has fixed the boundaries of the oceans. There will no more be a cataclysmic judgment by water. There'll be another cataclysmic judgment, but it will not be by water. Well, the writer here in the seventh verse is observing this hydrological process, this pattern, this cyclical pattern. And he's not gathering a whole lot of sense out of it, although it is very exciting how that process goes on, you see, if you're at all interested in growing things. Okay, so here he turns for the fourth illustration of a repetitious activity under the sun, where we have growth, or decay, or at least movement in a cyclical pattern or in a constant cycle. The fourth one of these was a hydrological pattern. The water processes of the earth. Okay? Now, in verse 8, Solomon turns now to man's ceaseless activity, to man's ceaseless work under the sun. And he comes up with a question. All things are full of labor. And the concept of labor there is the same concept that you have in these hydrological and these wind patterns, in the movement of the cosmos or the earth in relationship to the sun, in the life movement. All things are full of labor. They're wearisome. They are full of ceaseless movement, full of activity that is fatiguing, tiring, right? If you're a child, your life pattern, your activity is you're involved in schoolwork. And so you're getting up in the morning, and you eat a breakfast, and you're off to school. And in the afternoon, you come home from school and you play a little bit, and you're in a groove. And you're in a groove all winter. And it's good when you have vacation. If you're an adult, you get up in the morning, you eat your breakfast, and you go to work. And you put so many hours in at work. And there is an activity there. You come back, and you eat, and you sleep, and you get up, and you go to work, and you get up. There's a routine, you see. And this is what he has in mind. He is now moving. He is now moving his thought to the same type of activity relative to Homo sapiens. So he says in verse 8, all things are full of labor. Ceaseless movement that is fatiguing. Human language cannot exhaust, cannot utter this growth and decay, this movement in constant cycle. The eye is not satisfied with seeing. It is not fulfilled with seeing this. The ear is not fulfilled or satisfied with hearing. The thing that has been, it shall be again. And that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. Now, what is he saying there? Well, how would we express that today? Or what expression would summarize verse 9 that you've heard? All right, read it again. The thing that has been, it shall be. It is that which shall be. That which is in the past, it's going to be again. Like one generation passes away, another one comes on the scene, but the earth keeps on going. Sun rises, so on. Things, activities in the past, come again. The thing that has been, it shall be. That which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. What is he saying? How would you phrase that in your own words? Is everybody awake? Pardon?
What's that, Fred?
Okay, that's one way you might say. What does he mean when he says that which has been, that shall be? That which is done is that which shall be done. Okay, recurring process in what?
In what? Huh, that's right. Life, time, yeah, history. History is the study of time, space, Homo sapien beings in time, space, history. And what the way this could be expressed today is history repeats itself. It's going to repeat itself. But history really does not repeat itself. Human beings repeat themselves. We can learn from history so that we don't repeat the errors of the past. Over the CU library, do I remember this correctly? If I don't, I should. He that learns not from the past remains always a child. Is that right? Sure it is. On CU library, he never matures. He can't learn from mistakes of the past. So Solomon is expressing a disparity. And the book is full of this disparity. He cannot figure out the meaning of life. Now this passage, look at verse 10. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It has been already of old time, which was before us. There is no remembrance of former things. Neither shall there be any remembrance of those things that are come with those that shall come hereafter. And the idea is of the activity, the ceaseless activity that goes on among human beings without any significance, without any meaning. So that there is a cyclical concept in this passage of human history and man's relationship to human history. Okay? Now in verse 12, he's now going to move to an explanation of how he came to this view. And from chapter 1, verse 12, all the way through chapter 4, he's going to talk about his personal experiences. So he now refers to himself and how he sought out, or how he determined in his mind that he was going to have a meaningful, purposeful life. In other words, at a point in his own experience, he says, this life is too meaningless to me. So I'm going to have a full life. If he were living today, they would call it what? The happy life. He was going to find fullness. He was going to discover fullness. He identifies himself very clearly in verse 12. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. That tense of that verb, was king, is a perfect tense. It means completed action. So we could translate that like a perfect tense. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. Past tense. Now we said the word preacher. This is the same word that is used in verse 1, coalesce. Coalesce can mean collector, a gatherer, in the sense of gathering people. It could also be a speaker in an assembly. And he would be the one that would call them to assembly. The Amplified wants to translate this word debater, and I think that that's pretty good in the sense that Solomon in the book is sort of delineating his philosophy of life toward the end of his life, and he is sort of debating with himself about the meaning of life. Okay, now, so we're told in a simple historical statement that the person who wrote the book, see, this is relative to the author. He was, first of all, the coalesce that's referred to in the book. He is, secondly, king of Israel, king over Israel, which would be all Israel, United Kingdom, which meant that he was very influential, very powerful, influential. And thirdly, it was in Jerusalem. He was king in Jerusalem. Okay, which was an urbane population culture, or populous culture, cultural center of the ancient world. Now, Jerusalem was never a large city. It never could compare with Athens or Alexandria, Egypt, or even Antioch in Syria. But it was on the crossroads of the Fertile Crescent, and so that all trade that went around the Fertile Crescent had to pass at least through the Jerusalem area. Let's get the ancient world up here. Here's the Bosphorus Straits with Asia Minor coming down here, which we call Turkey today, and come down around the coast to Mount Carmel and then down to Egypt and so on. There's the Nile, the Red Sea, and the Gulf of Aqaba, and the Dead Sea, and Sea of Galilee, and Jordan. And this is out of proportion, but coming up over here is the Persian Gulf. And up here, again, it has to be over farther, but I'll throw it in here. That's Caspian Sea, largest inland body of water in the world, part of Russia today. Now, this Fertile Crescent, named by the historian Breasted, the great English scholar on Egypt, said if you flew over this in an airplane, it looked just like a Fertile Crescent, because this was Arizona out in here, or the Mojave Desert, and this was like a green strip that runs all the way around there. The green in Palestine comes from the green hills of Galilee and the Jordan that waters this down here, and then, of course, as you move down this way, it gets more arid. Well, anybody that, you see, the big trade route, here comes the Euphrates River down into the Persian, here comes the Tigris River. The source of these two rivers is only 50 miles apart up here in the mountains of Armenia, but it takes them 1,400 miles before they connect, these two rivers. And these were the sources of irrigation for the whole Mesopotamia Valley. And they had irrigation in the Mesopotamia Valley as early as
probably 3000 BC. This is a very fertile area, so in the trade routes, he ran this way and back, so that Jerusalem was a sort of a key city on those trade routes. So it was an urbane, populous, cultural center in the ancient world. So that the person who wrote this book had a responsible position. He was endowed. He was successful in terms of his his occupation, at least. He'd be looked upon as success from human viewpoint. He had the means of pursuing any goals that he set. Now, as you read the succeeding verses, particularly through 2:11, it could be nobody but Solomon. Now, in verse 13, he tells us what his goal was. Okay? I gave my heart. Heart, both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, always means the deepest resources of the soul, mind, spirit, intellect. We call that in this church the frame of reference. If you'll take one of those little booklets that we talked about from the rack and look up frame of reference, or look up the word heart in here, we describe what it is. And what he's saying is, I set my heart. You can underline this. In verse 13, I gave my heart to search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. In other words, I set myself to understand human activity and the results of it. In verse 17, he says, I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. In chapter 2, verse 1, it says, I said in my heart. He was communing with himself. In verse 3, he says, I sought in my heart. Okay? So in other words, Solomon is concerning himself with these musings that went on in the deepest resources of his mind, spirit, intellect, relative to life and the meaning of life. Okay? Verse 13. Okay. And I gave my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. Now, it has to be the wisdom that's under the sun, because there is very little application of divine wisdom in the book. It's dealing with what knowledge was available. So when he's talking about wisdom of that day in verse 13, that wisdom has to be the knowledge available in his day. This would be the knowledge. And resources of his day. And it's apart from special revelation. He's going to make a cabinet like John F. Kennedy wanted to make. John F. Kennedy's thesis was, let's pull in all the brains from Harvard into Washington, and they will become the chief advisors in Washington. And on the basis of an intellectual approach, we will solve the problems of the American society, and we will have a new frontier. It didn't work. Can't solve the problems of society on the basis of an egghead approach. I hope that we learn that. Well, this is what Solomon was doing. He says, I gave my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom concerning all things done in the sin. This sore travail. Now notice, he's almost giving us a conclusion. This battle, this sore travail had God given to the sons of men to be exercised with. And what he's saying in the verse is that God has given that job to man to stimulate man. Let man struggle with this problem of the meaning of life, the struggle and the attainment, and the meaningfulness of man's achievements. Okay? And he calls it sore travail. In other words, what he really is going to discover is that the struggle and attainment, achievement that man is capable of making under the sun,
is not satisfactory or is not a satisfaction for man's heart. In other words, it will not bring complete satisfaction. Instead, it is going to bring sore travail or weariness of mind, soul, spirit. So again, the negativeness is going to come through. Verse 14. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun. Now consider that statement, will you? I have seen all the works that are done under the sun. Could Solomon do that? Oh, by all means. He had the wherewithal and the means to follow his desires to their ultimate end, which means he probably made a trip down the Nile. As you sail down the Nile, you go through Egyptian history. Egyptians weren't concerned about history. They were very much like 20th century. And up here at Memphis, you see the pyramids of Giza and the Sphinx, which are part of the old kingdom of Egypt. They date from 2500 B.C. And as you go down, the capital of Egypt is moved. Till finally you get down here to Thebes and you have the capital of the new kingdom, see? Now apparently Solomon had visited some of these works. He maybe even knew how they built the pyramids. We don't know today how they built them. How did they get those huge stones across the sand and then get them into place where, you know, did you ever consider the problems of building a pyramid? I mean, not on the beach. See, this pyramid is a four-sided figure. So that all these outside rocks have to be cut with a compound angle in order to fit properly on there. And those things are huge. I forget what the average stone is. 2 to 4 feet thick, 6 feet long? I don't remember. Should have looked it up, I guess. He may have known how they built the pyramids. It's hard for us to figure it out today. It's a fantastic piece of architecture. Now, Solomon probably had visited the Mesopotamian Valley and seen some of the wonders of the Mesopotamian Valley, the ziggurats, the temples of the Mesopotamian Valley. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon had not been built yet because Nebuchadnezzar wasn't alive yet. He married a girl from the mountains. So in order to keep her happy, he brought the mountains to Babylon, built the Hanging Gardens. It was for his wife who had been raised in the Zagros Mountains. Which means if you're going to live in Kansas, don't marry a girl from Denver. You have to build her something to keep her happy. Or else move back to Colorado. Well, anyhow, what Solomon is saying is, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun. I wonder if he visited the island of Crete and saw Minoan culture, or visited the capital of the Hittite kingdom in what we call Turkey today. He probably did. He had the money to travel that way. And instead of him coming away impressed and writing a book on it, he comes away and says, it's all vanity and vexation. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Hey, it sounds like the people of Jerusalem pitched in and sent him on one of those Bible land tours that people send pastors on. You know, everybody chips in and they're going to do the pastor a favor, and so they send them to see Israel in 7 days. He's wore out and bleary eyes. He's going to learn all about ancient history in 7 days. And he's going to come home and show you slides and tell you all he knows about ancient history. Now, if you wanted to invest your money properly, you'd give him 7 days off and say, here's some money, go down to the Denver Library and learn about the Holy. Take 7 days and learn about it, because you'd learn more down there than you would be going over there. So the idea is, when you send me for 3 months so I can really see to them. All is vanity and vexation of spirit. Verse 14, second repetition of this statement, which is found again and again in the book. Vanity is the concept of Hebel. And Hebel in Hebrew means emptiness, fruitlessness. Meaninglessness. Charlie Clough's church sent him to Palestine this year. And I think he spent a month, 5 weeks, in a city. Really, really enjoyed it. Really learned a lot. Took all kind of pictures. If you get down to Lubbock, you might ask him about it. Okay, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of the spirit. And vexation of spirit can be translated shepherding the wind. Or chasing the wind. In other words, trying to find the ultimate meaning of life and the summum bonum in life in all of this that he did was like trying to grab hold of the wind. It was about as dependable as the wind. Couldn't depend on it. So he comes up with a conclusion in verse 15. That which is crooked cannot be made straight. And he just comes up with a very negative conclusion. And this is an application to labor under the sun and philosophical research into the meaning of life. That which is crooked cannot be made straight. That which is wanting or defective or lacking or deficient cannot be numbered or cannot be put to an account. If your bank account is short, the only way you're going to correct it is to bring it up to snuff. That's the idea. Lo, I commune with my own heart, saying, what happened? Did I lose my light bulb? Guess I did. Did any other lights go out?
Yeah.
Anybody making coffee downstairs? Well, somebody check the circuit breaker. Sometimes it gets a little warm and goes out. Okay, verse 16. I commune in my heart and said, I am come to great estate and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I gave my heart to know wisdom, to really know what wisdom was. Okay? In other words, he gave himself to strive after knowledge and wisdom under the sun in hopes of bringing true satisfaction. And to know madness and folly. And I perceive that this also is grasping after the wind. For in much wisdom is much grief. Because the man who is knowledgeable is also confronted with many evils, negative things in life that he cannot correct. And it becomes frustrating to him. So with much wisdom, there is always much grief. That's a true statement. He that increases knowledge increases sorrow. The 50 IQ person who's in a mental hospital, he's not having any problems in life. He's having a good time. You're the one that's struggling with the issues of life because you're an intelligent person. So he decides that in this pursuit of wisdom, in verses 16 through 19, it didn't bring true satisfaction. So he takes the reverse in chapter 2, in verses 1 through 3, and he says, I'm going to follow a life of pleasure. I said in my heart, chapter 2, verse 1, go to now. Go to now in Hebrew is something like a statement in Greek. It means you can either translate it go or come. So he says, come now to my heart. He's rationalizing. I will prove thee with mirth, with pleasure. Now, his heart, again, repeat. Heart in Old Testament is always a reference to the deepest resources of the mind, intellect, soul of the person. So he's saying to his deepest resources, his frame of reference, come now, have a ball. I will prove thee with mirth, with pleasure. Enjoy pleasure. Follow a hedonistic philosophy of life. The highest good in life to a hedonist, the summum bonum, the maximum life, is pleasure, fun, sensual enjoyment. He says, I'm going to follow that. And his conclusion is, man, this is vanity also. In verse 2, the Hebrew personalizes or personifies laughter and madness. Not I said of laughter, but I said to laughter. Laughter, it is mad. I said to mirth. What doeth it? What do you accomplish? What does mirth and this sort of a hedonistic approach amount to? So he has to go back into the resources of his mind. So he says in verse 3, I sought in my heart to give myself to wine, get acquainting my heart with wisdom. Now, if you have an amplified or maybe a New American Standard, the concept there is, I sought in my heart to give my body to wine, yet keeping it under control with my frame of reference. In other words, he said, I'm going to experiment with a mind-affecting drug, alcohol in this case, and I'll try to keep it under control, and I'll see what that happens. And maybe this will help me to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. In other words, he's looking for a philosophy of life that he can recommend. And in our teenage generation in the United States today, the concept is I'll look to marijuana. That starts with, that's where it generally starts. We'll have a psychedelic drug of some effect on our mentality, and it moves generally from marijuana to some type of pill, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Same concept. The concept is the experimentation to find greater pleasure in life. Solomon found it to be vanity and vexation. And in this sense, the teenagers of today are not much different than the teenagers of my day or the teenagers or Solomon's day. Experimentation, seeking to find some meaning in life. I'm sorry to say that I'm not sorry to say that. I'm happy to say that. I'm sorry to say that what the teenagers experiment with today is much more dangerous than what we experimented with when I was a teenager. Drugs are not worth experimenting with. They're too dangerous. Even alcohol is a dangerous drug. Probably the most serious mind-affecting drug in the United States today, maybe not the most serious, but the one that is most prolific in our society is alcohol. It's a drug. It's a mind-affecting drug. Well, let's go on. Solomon now moves to possessions and accomplishment. He sets his mind in verse 16 and 17 to pursuing wisdom for this philosophy. In chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, he sets his mind on joy and pleasure and hedonism. In chapter 2, verses 4 through 8, he sets his mind on possessions and accomplishments. Let's see what happens. Verse 4, I made me great works. I builded me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens. Notice the I and the me. He is the focal point of this. He's trying to discover meaning in life. He had fantastic tomato plants. You know what I picked? I picked cauliflower plant. It weighed 4.5 pounds. Man, was it beautiful. Absolutely delicious. Super. I find some meaning in growing things. I think there's some meaning there. Solomon's not going to find too much here. I built him houses. He had, as you remember from the Song of Solomon, he had houses all over Palestine. Apartments in the north. He had stables in Megiddo that would house 1,400 horses. He had a copper smelting plant down in what is called Ezion Geber, at the Gulf of Aqaba. The man was just enormously wealthy. And he probably did a good job of all this. I planted trees and all them for all kind of fruits. I made me pools of water. He had a swimming pool and a whirlpool
at his summer home in the hills of Galilee, to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. He had a complete irrigation system. Verse 7. I got me servants and maidens and had servants born in my house. Pretty nice. He didn't have a problem of affluence in the sense of worrying about it like we do. Our problem is how are we going to get it? His problem was what am I going to do since I got it? I had great possessions, verse 7, of great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me had ranches. Isn't that nice? Boy, wouldn't it be nice to have a ranch? Horses, cattle, have your place out in the country, nice stream running through with trout in it. And you're a gentleman rancher. You don't have to worry about who's going to repair the fences. Benches. Isn't that nice? Boy, wouldn't it be nice to have a ranch, horses, cattle, have your place out in the country, nice stream running through with trout in it. And you're a gentleman rancher. You don't have to worry about who's going to repair the fences. Is that the summum bonum of your life? Is that your goal? Is that in your value system? Is that part of it? Boy, I'd sure like to have that. I'd just love to move out of Aurora. But will that solve the deepest needs of your heart? Solomon says it won't. And Solomon knew more about this than any of us will ever know in terms of experience. Right? Right. Verse 8, I gathered me also silver and gold. It didn't matter if the dollar was worthless. He had the real stuff and the peculiar treasure of kings and of the provinces. Wealth, courtly display. I gathered me men singers. He had a male choir and a female choir, women singers. And the delights of the sons of men. Now, King James says, as musical instruments, that's almost an impossible translation. A possible translation would be pourings or wines or something to that effect. Musical instruments is an impossible translation. What you have really in verse 8, where it says musical instruments of all sorts. I think I showed you this in the Song of Solomon. You have an expression like this. The word is shaddah, and then it's going to be repeated, only in a plural form. This is a singular. And this is followed by a word connected by this wow consecutive, which is and. And you have this word in a plural, shadoth. These are feminine nouns. And this comes from the word, you see the word, let's see, you see the shad here? See these two little stems? You know what shad means? Shad in Hebrew means breast. I gather to me breasts and breasts is the idea. And when you have a singular in Hebrew followed by a plural like this, it's an intensified concept. And what he's talking about is mistresses, concubines. See, Solomon was the Hugh Hefner of the ancient world. Hugh Hefner is not somebody new. His mentality has been around for a long time. Solomon not only pursued the lifestyle that Hugh Hefner pursued today, but Solomon saw the futility of it, something Hugh Hefner hasn't seen yet. Okay, in verse 9, he comes now, he's telling us about himself and his personal experience in this matter. So I was great, and I increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. And whatsoever my eyes desired, I kept not from them. He lived by sight. I withheld not my heart from any joy. I kept myself open from any joy that might present itself. For my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my portion, my profit, my reward of all my labor.
Verse 11, then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought. I took an empirical, objective approach, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity. Now, please underline all. All stands for the substance of all of his efforts in this. And what he's saying is nothing was lasting and real in terms of my heart. All was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. There was absolutely no meaning under the sun. There was nothing that I could find derive ultimate and lasting satisfaction for in terms of genuine profit for my soul. Okay, so I think what Solomon is talking about in this chapter is something like this. This is Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verses 4 through 2:11. And he's talking about unhappiness. He is not finding meaningfulness. Unhappiness is. Meaninglessness is. See? Number 1. A perpetual sameness, the perpetual sameness of day-by-day routine. Without the dynamic of Christ. That's chapter 1. Verses 4 through 11. And I think there's another point in this, and that's a mechanical cyclical view of the universe. A mechanical cyclical view of the universe. If you have been through college, you are a college graduate in any university in the United States, you have been subjected to a mechanical, cyclical view of the universe. You have been oriented to that. Your frame of reference is grooved in that if you listened to what was said, if you believed what was said. But in Jesus Christ and in our identification with God, we have a God who is involved in the historical process. And though there appears to be somewhat of a cycle in history, history is moving because God is involved in history. And it's moving in the direction that he knows about and that he wants it to move in the sense of determining the ultimate end of history. So if you've been oriented to the humanistic concept or to even to an empirical concept of what is happening in the universe at a university, you can hardly help but thinking like Solomon helps unless you orient to Jesus Christ. Secondly, human unhappiness or meaninglessness is human wisdom and knowledge. Human wisdom and knowledge not related to Jesus Christ. All it leads to is frustration and vanity. Chapter 1, verses 12 through 18. He sets his goals in that paragraph on the gathering to his heart or his mind of human wisdom. Thirdly, unhappiness, meaninglessness is pleasure apart from or not related to Jesus Christ. I'm happy to see some of you made it back from the hills tonight or from the hills today. You ought to be able to enjoy looking at the beautiful scenery of Colorado. For you tapers that are out of state, it's really not as nice as they make it out to be. Stay away. You ought to be able to appreciate that more fully than unbelievers, because you recognize that God made that for your enjoyment. He had man in mind when he made that. Point four,
unhappiness, meaninglessness is possessions. Possessions and accomplishments. And Solomon could boast of these. He did do a lot of building. He was a great civic leader in this term. Not related to the Lord Jesus Christ. Chapter 2, verses 4 through 7. Fifthly, unhappiness, meaninglessness is wealth apart from Jesus Christ. That's chapter 2, verse 8a. Point 6, unhappiness is music apart from Jesus Christ. That's 2:8b. Unhappiness, meaninglessness is sex apart from Jesus Christ. That's chapter 2, verse 8c. Okay. And Solomon comes up to a conclusion after relating all these experiences to us. And he says, I looked upon these experiences, upon the works that my hands had wrought, and all that my labor did, and behold, all was hebel, and the chasing of the wind, and there's no profit under the sun. That's not true. All is not vanity and vexation. There is profit under the sun. But an intelligent human being who is struggling for meaning, and every intelligent human being, every person who can think, cannot readily accept existence as meaningless. Deep inside every one of us is a need for a concept of purpose, a need to know that we are moving toward that purpose and toward that end and toward a working philosophy of life, a worldview that is realistic. The Germans have a name for it called the Weltanschauung. The only person who is capable of having an accurate worldview that is healthy and formed is a person who is rightly identified with Jesus Christ. He will see history as more than cyclical. He will see wisdom related to God in the divine plan. That will be the exalted wisdom, the summum bonum of wisdom. He will perceive joy and pleasure from divine viewpoint. He will be able to rightly relate to finances and money and human accomplishments. He will see them like God sees them. And he will not say all is vanity and vexation of spirit. He will say there is wisdom, or there is profit under the sun as we see things like Jesus Christ sees them. Well, I hope this is enough to introduce you to the struggles of the coalesce, the preacher, the assembler, that is referred to in Ecclesiastes. Next time I'm here, we'll take up with verse 12 of chapter 2 and deal more with the struggles that this man expresses. Any questions I could try to answer before we go? Yes, Tom? Well, it's a summary statement. It's a generalized statement of all that he swung into action. No, he did not do it all himself. Of course not. But it's like saying General Patton freed the Bastogne, the Battle of the Bastogne. What was that called? Well, the Battle of the Bastogne was captured in the Battle of the Bulge, but I thought they had a name, I forget. Well, anyhow, it's like saying General Patton freed the soldiers in Bastogne. Well, General Patton didn't really do it, but he was responsible for it. That's the same way here. Oh, yeah, that work is good and healthy and meaningful. Yeah, it could be part of it. Could be part of it. Yeah, it's good to get out and dig in the garden. Grow a tomato. Something you have to wait for. Yes, sir? Yeah, no, it's not. No, it's not even in there. No. The Septuagint translates it sort of like pourings of pourings, and then it's associated with wine. But it's not there, no.
And Solomon's earlier life and made a request for wisdom. Would that godly wisdom?
Yes.
No, because you see, it wasn't godly wisdom that led him to take the concubines.
His option to... This is a passage we had last week. I don't know if you were here or not. But the last passage we covered last week was the issue over what happened to Solomon since he was filled with godly wisdom when he became a king.
Well, in 1 Kings chapter 11... you have the explanation of Solomon's heart, his frame of reference, departs from the Lord. There were two things involved with it. One was the affluence, the money, and the other was were the women that he was involved with. And they led his heart away from the Lord, so his heart wasn't perfect with Jehovah.
So it wasn't the divine wisdom that led him to do that. That strictly was a human viewpoint thing that he opted for, and it led to his downfall. So the wisdom that's talked about in Ecclesiastes is not the same.
Yes, but he's not referring to the divine wisdom that he had in the other passage, in the other book. He's referring to the wisdom that he gathered in this later pursuit in his life. He still had that. He knew how to build things. He knew how to get things done. He knew something about plant life and animal life. He knew something about the cosmological processes of his day in terms of what they knew of that day. That's the wisdom he's referring to. He's not referring to divine wisdom. He's referring to the fact that he still had the wisdom, but it didn't bring satisfaction to his soul. But divine wisdom brings satisfaction to the soul, to the heart, to the frame of reference.
Divine wisdom is not vanity. It's not futile. It's not emptiness. Now, he's referring to the wisdom that he struggled with in the universities of his day. And what passed for philosophies and concepts that would meet the needs of his life in that day, they did not succeed. Same thing is true today. You go to a university today and you learn a lifestyle. You're supposed to learn how to think. But you pick up a lifestyle with it. Will the lifestyle meet the needs of your heart? Absolutely not, if it's not divine viewpoint lifestyle. Only that is found in Jesus Christ. Okay? Any other questions? Well, it's a very morbid book, and it'll get worse, so come back.
Shall we pray? Father, we pray that Your Spirit will stimulate each of us who are believers to examine our values and our goals relative to these experiences of Solomon and relative to what the New Testament says about what our priorities ought to be in this age. And help us to come to divine viewpoint decisions about what will be important to each of us, we pray in Christ's name. Amen.